You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, residents in Vilas County have raised concerns about timber harvesting practices from the state DNR. A reporter will tell us more about the issue and the DNR response. Now, a Wisconsin limnologist was recently awarded the Blue Planet Prize, a global recognition awarded to those for outstanding scientific and environmental research. He's been studying lakes in Wisconsin for decades with a focus on food webs, lake ecologies, and how human activity changes them. Steve Carpenter is a free-range scientist and professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for Limnology. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, first off, Steve, congratulations on this Blue Planet Prize. What does getting the recognition mean to you?
Well, I did not know much about it until I got the call awarding it, and I'm deeply honored. Now I know that many scientists around the world who I deeply respect have won it in the past. The mission of the prize is to repair and preserve the natural world that keeps us alive, and that is a pretty good description of the research that I've been doing throughout my career. So I'm deeply honored.
Steve, we've talked to you a lot over the years about what's going on under our water. I'm curious, though, what first drew you to studying lakes, and what's kept you interested in them all these years?
Well, I was initially drawn to them just because the science is interesting. And I had a professor who taught me ecosystem science when I was very young, when I was a sophomore and junior. Lakes just resonated with the ideas that I learned as an undergraduate. Over the years, as I came to Wisconsin then for grad school, because he told me that Wisconsin is the center of the universe for the study of lakes. So if you're interested in lakes, you got to go to Wisconsin. And I was a Midwesterner by birth and really loved Wisconsin when I got here. And over the years, I would say my research has increased in scale. So initially, I worked on the phosphorus cycle within lakes and the food web interactions and the ecological dynamics that control the phosphorus cycle. And then as time went on, I moved up to thinking about multiple lakes on a landscape, to thinking about regional systems of lakes and people, so how people work together with lakes and the land. Now I spend a lot of my time thinking about the planetary system of people and nature.
And Steve, you've been, as you said, researching lakes for over four decades now. Looking over that time, what are some of the big ways that Wisconsin's lakes have been changing during that period? What's kind of the tail of the tape?
Well, for one thing, we're seeing more nutrient pollution going into the lakes. And the reason is intensification of agriculture primarily, and also climate change. So we are getting more storms, bigger storms, and those storms are increasing the amount of phosphorus, nitrogen, and other chemicals being washed into the lakes. So that is one big change. Another change is that really for the first time, we need to think about warming water, warmer water conditions interacting with invading species from further south and from other countries, changing the food webs of the lakes. And when I wrote my first paper about climate change, which was about 30 years ago, we really weren't thinking about the interaction of warming with species migrations, but it's a big deal now.
And what are some of those species that are maybe having a tough time now that were maybe thriving, say, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, the most famous one is walleye, and walleye decline has been in the newspaper almost annually for several years. My colleague, Dr. Holly Emke, formerly from Center for Limnology and now at USGS, has recently conducted a study on where she tried to increase recruitment of walleye by removing the predators of baby walleye from a lake. And unfortunately, it wasn't successful, but it, like in science, sometimes you just have to try something. And when the cards come in, you read them and weep, and then you move on to the next thing. And at least now we know we need to be trying something else.
Talking with Steve Carpenter right now, Professor Emeritus with UW's Center for Limnology, recent recipient of the Blue Planet Prize. And Steve, on the positive end, are there positive changes you've seen in your time studying lakes or things happening now that hold some promise for our waterways?
You know, the project that has encouraged me the most recently is working on Yahara 2070 with a number of colleagues here at UW-Madison and also with people in the community. And in that project, we developed four different stories of how the future might unfold. And each story is really about a regional experiment we might do to improve the lakes. And after discussing those stories with the public, we then translated the stories and the public's concerns into computer models and into a short story contest, into art, just had terrifically positive discussions, I think, about mitigating the problems of the lakes. And I think here in Dane County, we're lucky to live in one of the most innovative counties in the world, in my opinion. And I've worked with land managers on several continents now and many different countries. And Dane County is just doing a great job trying to have the lakes coexist with agriculture and maintain a lake quality that we can live with. I'm not saying they're done. There's a lot of work to do, but it's a really creative group.
And Steve, I know you're not finished with studying lakes and coming up with solutions for them as this Blue Planet Prize focused on. What are some of the things that you are still wanting to know or still excited about for the future?
Well, actually, I'm spending most of my time thinking about global change and about things like the climate problem. And I think the phosphorus problem in lakes is a microcosm of the global climate problem. Phosphorus is an out of control chemical cycle, and carbon is an out of control chemical cycle. And I think that some of the insights we're getting about working with the public on improving lakes might be translated into dealing with a carbon problem. And this is a topic that I'm working on with collaborators in Sweden.
Well, Steve, congratulations again on the award. Always good to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to chat with you. I appreciate it.
That was Steve Carpenter, free-range scientist and professor emeritus at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. We talked to them about receiving this year's Blue Planet Prize, a global award for environmental research, and looking back on his career on researching lake ecology here in Wisconsin, the U.S., and now the world. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about welcoming pests.
Ever feel like you're constantly battling garden invaders? Dealing with the weeds, bugs, and critters can be a never-ending, daunting task. Or you can roll with it, just like author B.J. Hollers and his family.
My neighbors did the logical thing. Rolled out the chicken wire, planted the stakes, and transformed their garden into a fortress. Sun and Rain still had access, though no longer the rabbits or the raccoons or the deer. Much of the garden's beauty was gone, but the crop remained. Sprigs of parsley, carrot greens, summer squash. It was a price my neighbors were willing to pay. Meanwhile, our garden was quite the opposite. Unencumbered, free, and for every critter with whom we shared our neighborhood, a smorgasbord of earthly delights. My wife and I attempted our own deterrent, recruiting a plastic owl who served admirably for all of an hour, at which point the rabbits grew wise to our dead-eyed sentinel, viewing him more as a maitre d' than our tactical defense force. One morning in late May, in the days prior to the invasion, my 5-year-old son stood beside me in the yard and said, rather unceremoniously, "Oh look, a deer." I turned to spot a fawn half hidden in clover, his snout bobbing like a dowsing rod. He lay folded atop a bed of needles, staring at my son as my son stared back. Two creatures too young to be afraid. In retrospect, I should have been the one to be afraid. I now see that fawn for what he was, the opening salvo of the onslaught soon to come, whose presence became so routine that some nights we all dined al fresco. My young family hunched in their lawn chairs, popsicles dangling, while the rabbits and squirrels made short work of everything edible. It was easier to marvel than be mad, and so we did. By mid-July, it was clear we had a problem. Not with the pests, but with our neighbors. While they worked hard to keep the animals away, we worked hard to recruit them. Had we been cable TV subscribers, we might have filled our time otherwise. But since we weren't, we took our front row seats in the lawn chairs, reveling in the animals' displays. Equally curious, the animals watched us too, shooting us looks which, roughly translated, meant, "Have you people never heard of chicken wire?" 6 months later, long after the garden was gone and our plastic owl was neck deep in snow, I peeked out the back window to spot 3 deer nosing through the hoarfrost. They were more apparition than animal, more guest than pest. I like to think they were a family, and that perhaps the littler one was the one we'd met in the clover the previous spring. That morning, when the deer returned, the world was so cold it could snap. So cold, I swear I saw a shimmer of heat rising from their fur. Long after they'd left me, their hoof prints held firm in the snow. A reminder, not of what we'd lost, but of all we'd been given.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, the state DNR is confident an investigation will show it's following timber harvesting standards correctly. We'll learn more about the story with a WPR reporter. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, the easy breezy lifestyle seen so often on TikTok isn't just aimed at young people. We'll look at why more older influencers are showing up on the app and showing off lavish lifestyles and peel back the layers of what we're seeing. That's coming up at 6 o'clock on 1A+. Now, residents in northern Wisconsin's Vilas County are concerned about how the State Department of Natural Resources is applying its water quality standards when it comes to logging and timber sales along shorelines. The DNR says it's been following its own rules, but an investigation is now underway by an outside organization. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She's been following the story. I talked with her earlier today. Danny, can you tell us what standards these two northern Wisconsin residents are accusing the DNR of not following?
Yeah, so the Wisconsin DNR has forestry standards for protecting water quality, specifically near, you know, forestry activities like logging. And so they're accusing the DNR of violating their own best management practices to protect water quality near areas, near lakeshore areas that have been logged.
And can you tell us what your initial concerns were, where they first noticed them?
Yeah, this is something that started when, you know, these two friends, they got together and they were going out for an early morning hike back in 2020 in the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest near the town of Boulder Junction in northern Wisconsin. And so they were out walking and then they started seeing paint marks on the trees and they knew that, you know, that designates or you typically designates a timber sale. And so as they got closer and closer to the water, they started to become concerned about the trees that were marked for harvest and felt that it was really a heavy cut or appeared to be what would be a heavy harvest near the lakeshore.
And how close to a lakeshore does the DNR allow itself to harvest timber?
Yeah, under the DNR's best management practices, they recommend a riparian management zone or this buffer zone of 100 feet or more whenever there's a harvest near the lakeshore. And that's to protect water quality. The DNR does have the ability to adjust, you know, those buffer zones as they see fit, as long as it doesn't impact water quality.
And the two residents we've mentioned first noticed this on Whitney Lake in Vilas County. Did they see a similar thing in other nearby lakes?
Yeah, Whitney Lake was just the first one where they became concerned. And after that, they began a more extensive process and actually kind of initiated their own evaluation where they independently went out and looked at 15 lakes in northern Wisconsin. And on some of these lakes, they actually went and counted every single tree that was marked for a harvest in that zone. And so what they found through their own investigation is that the DNR was violating its own standards on 9 out of 15 lakes, or that's what they're accusing the DNR of.
So these concerns were brought to the DNR. What was the response from the agency?
The DNR met with these two residents and discussed their concerns. They discussed it through emails and through field visits, but these residents still felt that they weren't in compliance with the state's own standards to protect water quality. And so basically they asked for a special audit from the DNR's auditor, SCS Global Services, who conducts annual audits of the agency every year just to measure whether or not they're meeting requirements to retain their Forest Stewardship Council certification. And that certification basically ensures that, you know, any products that come from the state's forests meet environmental, social, and economic benefits. And it helps wood products from the state of Wisconsin to remain competitive in global markets.
We're talking with Danielle Kading right now, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at a story of two residents in northern Wisconsin accusing the DNR of not following its own standards when it comes to how close timber harvesting is allowed nearby a shoreline. And Danny, what was the result of that audit that you mentioned?
So the result of that special audit, at first, the DNR's auditor found that the first lake that they had initially filed complaints over, Whitney Lake, that timber sale had in fact failed to comply with the DNR's best management practices or standards for water quality because trees were cut less than 100 feet from the lakeshore and they weren't evenly distributed across the landscape. But the DNR appealed those findings and last year the auditor kind of reversed course and said there was a misunderstanding between how the DNR and residents viewed that buffer zone and where it started. And so basically they said that this spot painted red line that marked trees in that zone was actually an area where logging equipment was not allowed, and it didn't designate that riparian management zone where they don't recommend that you harvest.
And what was the response of the residents then to those findings of those audits?
Well, they thought that that special audit was faulty and flawed. They were very upset with SCS Global Services and their findings. And so basically they decided they were going to go to the auditor and ask this group from Germany, Assurance Services International, to conduct their own investigation and look into the auditor's findings and see whether or not the DNR is in fact violating their own standards to protect water quality at these logging sites near lakeshores.
So Danny, there's a lot going on here. What is the next step that you have your eye on?
Yeah, so the next step is that Assurance Services International has agreed to investigate residents' complaint. They're going to be conducting an on-site visit of some of these sites that are contested. And they haven't scheduled a visit yet, to my knowledge, but residents are hoping that that will take place sometime this summer.
Well, we'll leave it there and keep an eye on this story. Danny, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thanks, Dean.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us today about concerns raised by two Vilas County residents about logging practices by the state DNR near lakes in northern Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, authoritarian governments take hold one step at a time. That's according to our guest, who shares ways that the media can do better at covering threats to democracy. We'll also talk with a researcher in Wisconsin studying forgiveness. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then record-breaking temperatures are hitting Europe, and highs in the triple digits are expected in parts of the U.S. this week. We'll talk to an expert on extreme heat about the health risks and why scientists say heat waves are getting more common. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've worked in customer service, you know that putting on a happy face isn't always easy. We'll talk with a Wisconsin researcher about the challenges of emotional labor and how customers and employers can make things less stressful. First, record-breaking temperatures have hit Europe in recent weeks, leading to hundreds of deaths and worsening conditions for wildfires in southern Europe. In the U.S., triple digits are expected this week in the Plain States, with temps that could go as high as 115 degrees. Our next guest says extreme heat can have serious, even deadly effects for those of us living through it. He's with us to explain what's driving the extreme heat we're seeing, how it's connected to climate change, and what we can do about it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed more heat waves where you live? Does the heat dictate in part what you do and don't do? Have you experienced any heat-related illnesses like heat exhaustion? And if you work outside, what are the hot summer months like for you in your job? Are they getting worse? Call 800-642-1234. And that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Chris Uejo is an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State. He studies how the physical environment affects health and well-being. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here, Dean.
Well, temperatures in some parts of Europe are starting to cool down a bit today, but it's still really hot in other areas. And I mentioned those triple-digit temperatures expected soon here in the U.S. What do we know about what's driving all this heat right now?
Sure. So extreme heat is a widespread and pernicious problem. While in some respects, some of the same weather patterns may be promoting extreme heat across the United States and parts of Europe, there is an intensification or an amplification of some of those weather patterns that's essentially causing these periods of short and extreme intense heat to become more intense, longer lasting, geographically widespread due to climate change.
And 100 degree day is an occasional thing here in Wisconsin and other parts of the U.S., but Britain and France are less used to that. Can you talk about how significant the temperatures they're seeing are right now?
Sure. One way to think about it is there's a weather station that in the central part of the United Kingdom that has records going back to the 1700s, and this is by far the hottest day that they've seen. So I'm currently based in Florida, though I'm familiar with Wisconsin and did my graduate studies there. So while it may seem not that extreme to a Floridian or someone in the southern United States, to a place that is not adapted to extreme heat, something like a 40 degrees Celsius day is life-threatening and can bring some consequences, not just to human health, but closing down of airports and critical infrastructure and other cascading impacts to society.
And I'd imagine what qualifies as extreme in one area depends partly on, as you said, how well adapted a city or a country is to heat and kind of the safeguards they have in place. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So many of us think of things like, particularly here in the United States, we might initially think of access to air conditioning and cooling, but also our bodies normally physiologically adapt over the course of the summer season. So we're more, if it was this, we experience the same heat exposures in, say, the end of August, we'd be more readily available to respond to that versus the beginning of May, for example. There's also adaptations such as federal regulations on safe work to rest ratios, how we build and design our cities, and even when it's okay to take breaks due to the extreme heat.
And what does the data tell us about how this extreme heat and the frequency of it is changing over time?
Sure, great point. So we know that pretty much across the world, the frequency of, with high confidence, the frequency of these extreme heat events, or in this case, I may call them heat waves, but these sort of short, multi-day, notably different than previous conditions of higher heat exposures are becoming more common, longer lasting, and geographically widespread, meaning covering a larger area and exposing more people. So essentially, this is just part of our trajectory, unfortunately, towards a different climate future.
We're talking with Chris Uwejo right now, an associate professor at Florida State University who studies how physical environments affect health and well-being. We're talking about the heat waves we're seeing right now in Europe, hot temperatures expected across much of the U.S. this next week. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Has the high heat affected your work, what you do in your day-to-day life? Have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, we talked a little bit about it, but could you expand a bit on the health impacts and the physical symptoms that can come with high heat?
Sure. We're learning, and so while we understand a fair amount about extreme heat, we're learning more and more every day. And what we're finding out is extreme heat is impacting a much wider range of our health systems and our body's regular functioning than we had previously understood. So some of that is well recognized, such as our cardiovascular system. Essentially, your heart has to work harder to pump more blood to the skin to dissipate heat. Our respiratory system, your lungs, essentially breathing in hotter and humid, more humid air is more work for your lungs. Our kidney system, essentially our renal system and kidneys, their dehydration and a variety of different pathways may be impacted by extreme heat. But we're also encountering some things that we weren't initially expected, such as mental health complications. We know that those 911 medical 911 calls for those also systematically increase across the nation during high heat periods. So both there, it's more than just heat exhaustion and heat stroke, but also for those with pre-existing health conditions, and there's quite a variety of those that could be exacerbated by extreme heat exposure.
And who should be most on the lookout for the effects of high heat on their physical well-being?
Great question. So everyone is at risk for extreme heat, but some groups face higher risks. So as you're mentioning in your place, that's not as well adapted like the United Kingdom. Everyone faces higher risks. If you are in a place that does have some social or physiological adaptations, there's still some groups that we're most concerned about. And it's a pretty wide, they span a wide gamut of the population. Some of those include older adults who are more likely to have pre-existing health conditions, some of the ones that we had mentioned, and also take medications that might increase their heat sensitivity or dehydration, pregnant people, and newborns, and related to that, sort of young children, as well as all the way up to those who are engaging in youth sports or youth activities outdoors when they may not be acclimated to these high heat exposures. Along those same lines, people who work or exercise outdoors have higher heat exposures and therefore risk. And sort of a key group that we're seeing here in the southern part of the United States is the unhoused, or essentially people who cannot avoid some of these higher heat exposures.
Yeah, could you talk a bit more about the question of, I guess, equity across social class here and income and wealth and how that can affect who is most affected when we see some of these heat waves?
Sure. Income is really important, and more so these days when we know that there's an energy crisis and the price of electricity may be increasing for many people. So we know that the impacts of heat on health are inequitable. We know that people who are more likely to work outdoors are also to be more likely to be lower income and to some extent people of color. One way that I sort of framed to think about this was there is this very rich hotel in Dubai that proposed creating the world's first air conditioning beach. Stated another way that maybe those with the highest economic resources can afford to adapt even for leisure. But those who have limited means to adapt are really bearing the brunt of that, and that's both within the United States and globally.
Sure. I know that I think all of us probably recognize the impact on our electricity bill when we turn the AC on for the summer. It costs money. Certainly costs money if that AC goes down. And Chris, I understand that you have some experience with that growing up and the AC being out on what always seems like the hottest day of the year.
Yes, definitely. I lived in Arizona before I had moved to Wisconsin to do my graduate studies. And as a graduate student, you know, my rent was $250 a month, and which was less than what I would pay during the summer for energy. But living in an apartment like that, almost every summer, without fail, my cooling system would break down during the hottest part of the summer. And one day I did personally experience extreme heat. I won't say it's not a life or death experience, but it is unsettling. Your heart starts to be out of control and nothing you can do can calm it down, whether that's trying to run your arms underwater or put your head in, until I took the drastic step of putting my head in the freezer to finally start to calm myself down. And I've had enough of these episodes that I can't say there's much good to have come from it. The only good thing of living in a place where you've had not great infrastructure is that the heat was strong enough to kill the bed bug.
We're talking with Chris Owejo right now, professor at Florida State University who studies extreme heat and the public health response to it. He's with us today to talk about the heat wave happening in Europe and more hot temperatures expected in the U.S. this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of heat waves becoming more common with climate change? Does the heat affect the way you work, your job, where you've chosen to live? What questions do you have about trends in extreme heat, and are there ways you'd like to see us better prepare for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about extreme heat, what's causing it, the link to climate change, and how it impacts people's health. Chris Uejo with Florida State University stays with us. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. When the temperature rises, do you stay inside? Are you able to stay inside? If not, what impact does it have on your life and your work when it's 90, 100 degrees? And have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Chris, earlier we were talking a little bit about some of the things that cities, states, countries can do to adapt to our current reality of frequent heat waves. What are some of the things you've seen around the U.S., maybe at the city level, that hold some promise in keeping people safe from the heat?
Sure. Wisconsin's a bit of a leader in this area. I've had the pleasure of working with, I used to run a program for the state of Florida, and then I would run across my Wisconsin counterparts, Megan Christensen and Colleen Moran, John Myman. But essentially, they've done a variety of things. First is just trying to figure out who is suffering and when these groups are suffering from extreme heat so that one can start to target those interventions. And then perhaps moving a bit to another example, there's a variety of leaders there. There is no sort of gold standard yet, but there's places like New York City that are doing everything from testing out programs where they have volunteers check in with their neighbors during extreme heat episodes. And they have also, during COVID, when their cooling shelters or refuges were shut down, they had disseminated air conditioning units to those, as well as vouchers for the ability to pay for the air conditioning units to a variety of at-risk households.
Sure. So the actual act of having a network of people to check in on neighbors, check in on people living in a community if there is something like a power outage, say.
Yes. And what's wonderful about that, it's not necessarily a high expenditure sort of endeavor, and it builds community. The city of Philadelphia originally created the program. It was called from its Philly Blocks program, and it was originally actually created to target neighborhood crime. So the same thought being that if we are building in these stronger networks, maybe there's some other potential benefits to building communities and to increase resilience, not just to heat, but to a variety of other hazards or disasters.
And public cooling centers, is that something that we see holding some promise too for this kind of problem?
Great question. I'd say the jury's still out. It is probably the most common preferred method by municipalities to address extreme heat at the moment. There's been some limited work looking at how effective that really is. Some places are running them really well and effectively, but there are some well-known roadblocks to those. For many of them, you might need to have a car to get to them, which is a large challenge. Some of them are not open during the evening times, et cetera. But at this point, I think the more that I still applaud those municipalities heading down this path as sort of a first step towards taking further action.
And for people who exercise, or especially young people who play sports outside during the hot weather, that can be especially dangerous. Are there rules? Are there standards out there that you would kind of recommend more places implementing when it comes to practices, games outside?
Yes, absolutely. For the past 30 years or so, and even beyond that, we've heard, unfortunately, stories of mostly professional athletes, but also locally, I'm sure, in your communities as well, of perhaps most commonly football players, but certainly other people who play other sports as well, suddenly falling ill from heat-related illness and dying on the field. So the Corey Stringer Institute, among others, is a leader in this field. They come up with a ranking with how well certain jurisdictions are doing for heat-related guidance. But long story short is we have a pretty clear guidebook on how to prevent heat-related illness in our young athletes. Essentially, you have to acclimate them to following similar protocols that we use for outdoor workers. You'd have to have medical staff who are trained and on the scene and know how to respond to heat-related illness. And you'd have to be willing to reschedule some events if they're going to take place during unsafe conditions.
And Chris, something that we hear about maybe when we talk to our neighbors in the southern U.S. is, oh, it's 105 degrees, but it's a dry heat. And here in Wisconsin, I think we all sort of dread the humidity. Is there a difference when it comes to the danger heat poses when it's drier or when it's more humid?
Sure. Great questions. Both have their challenges. So if in a place like Wisconsin, where you could potentially get weather systems or air masses with both types, a dry heat from the desert or a more moister heat from my neck of the woods, right, both can be harmful. The all else being equal, the same number or heat, temperature number, the moister heat is more dangerous because it limits the body's ability to sweat, which is its most effective way to cool down. But that being said, I wouldn't scoff at a high dry heat either. As for example, Arizona is the nation's leader in the number of heat-related deaths still, largely due to its dry heat.
And in general, Chris, at all levels of government, whether that's local, whether that's federal, do you think that there's enough action on this issue right now, especially seeing that we're likely going to be experiencing more heat waves in the future, or do we need a little more urgency around this?
Yes, absolutely need more action here. We need to deploy chief heat resilience officers. I've had the pleasure of working with Jane Gilbert in Miami-Dade County and her team as the world's first chief heat resilience officer. We need to have metrics to track what's happening with extreme heat and how we can manage it, and as well as these creative interventions that have win-win potential with some of the other things that are important to us, whether that's stormwater mitigation or greenhouse gas mitigation, or just providing more green or verdant neighborhoods that are provide physical activity space opportunities. So unfortunately, there isn't a dedicated, even a federal agency that is really in charge of extreme heat. NOAA is sort of stepping up to the plate at the moment, but the funding has not been there. And some of the other climate health funding, unfortunately, did not come through with Build Back Better and sort of its related offshoot. So it still is an all-hands-on-deck moment.
And as we wrap up, Chris, what are you watching for next when it comes to either the weather forecast or how we here are doing it, responding to it?
Sure. Right. I know that a lot of this sounds more like doom and gloom, and but I do see glimmers of hope. I see glimmers of hope every time there's a new chief heat officer. Hope whenever there's more interest. I think I haven't seen, to be honest, this much interest in my 17 years working on extreme heat on this topic until this year, and I think that's helpful for it. I'm looking for sort of creative out of the box ways to also to deal and prevent with extreme heat in an equitable fashion, whether that's energy subsidies, whether that's installing a cooling safe space or resilience hub in a low-income housing and high-rise unit. There's a variety of things that, to be honest, I don't think we've fully thought of that are needed. So we need you, we need your listeners, we need everyone to bring their creative energies to some of these wicked problems.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
That was Chris Uejo. He's an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State University. He was with us today to talk about the impact of extreme heat, with record heat in Europe and triple-digit temperatures expected in parts of the U.S. next week. Coming up after the news, working in customer service jobs takes a lot of emotional energy. A UW-Milwaukee professor shares her research on the toll it can take and how to make those tough interactions less likely. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.